This podcast is a member of WGPRN, WildGamesProductions.com.
Prepare for wizardly combat.
I want to show you a trick Mother showed me when you weren't around.
And I'll not laugh for a step up to feel the
end. Welcome to Spellburn, a podcast covering the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game and old-school adventuring. It's time to party like it's 1974.
This is the true story of three judges picked to be on a podcast to talk about their favorite game and be recorded, so we can find out what happens when players stop making saving throws and start getting crits. Welcome to the real Spellburn. I'm your host, Judge Jim, and we're here this episode with my two dungeon crawling co-hosts, Judge Job.
Hodor.
And Judge Jeffrey.
Hello, everyone.
And with us today is our very special guest, Judge Michael Curtis.
Hi, everybody. I have been successfully summoned from the plane of perpetual deadlines to appear here on Spellburn, and I'm happy to be here.
Mike's graciously allowed us to invoke Patron and pick his brains on some of his game design philosophy this week, and we'll move this on into the tavern.
The first rule of bartending is this: GBTB. Go beyond the book. Go beyond the book.
What do you have?
Heineken. F*** that.
Tavern talk. Okay, so what did we all do in gaming this week? Job, you want to start us off? What have you been up to?
I haven't gamed too much this week. I've got a convention coming up, Go Play Northwest, next weekend. So I've just kind of been doing a little bit of preparation for my game there. I'm going to run the One Who Watches From Below and something else. I haven't totally decided yet. How about you, Jeffrey?
I actually had a pretty busy week in gaming. Origins was here in Columbus last week, so I was there pretty much four or five of the days. Dungeon Crawl Classics related-wise, I ran the Waystation, which is from Purple Duck Games, ran that as a one-shot. That went pretty well. That was a good adventure, fit into a convention time slot pretty well. The other one Michael will surely be familiar with, I ran Tower Out of Time, ran that for seven people Saturday afternoon.
I'm insanely jealous.
It was a good time. It was a lot of fun. So I ran that at Origins. And while at Origins, I also played 13th Skull. Our online gaming group actually all converged on Columbus last weekend. So all the people I've been like online gaming with on Tuesdays and sometimes Wednesdays joined in. So one of the guys from that group ran 13th Skull. That was a good time. We thought it was going to be a TPK pretty early on. And then thanks to an Invoke patron, we got our bacon save there. And we were quite successful at finishing that adventure. And then my normal weekly campaign continued this week after Origins, and we're still amidst Blades Against Death. So, and that's going along pretty well. We had a real good session. In fact, normally we try to knock it off around 10:30 because we got people that get up early the next day and things like that. And we hit that like 10:30, 10:35. And I'm like, well, folks, you know, what do you guys think? And they're all, let's keep going. Let's keep going. So I always like it when that happens. I think we ended up gaming until like 11:30. So usually a sign things are going well. So I think that's been a fun time too. So it was a pretty busy week for me gaming wise.
That's awesome. Michael, did you, in between your deadlines, did you get any gaming in this past week?
I did, actually. It wasn't DCC related, although I did finish up a new adventure for Goodman and submitted that on, I believe, Tuesday. So I suppose I could, ask for some indulgence in that matter. But as some of you may know, I mean, North Texas RPG Con was just 2 weeks ago, so I'm still kind of recovering from that. But on Monday night, we're starting up a new playtesting campaign for a new game that I've been working on and off for the last year. And I've run a couple of public playtests of it. And this summer, our usual campaign is kind of going on a hiatus because we have somebody out of state. So me and the remaining players have decided we're going to actually give the new game a good kind of extended test run. So we'll be doing that throughout the summer. So Monday was just character generations and trying to explain the setting and the rest of it. So I can figure out what we're going to do with it. So that was my gaming participation for the week.
That sounds pretty sweet. Of course, Mike and I got up to some DCC shenanigans at North Texas Con. I talked about that in the other podcast I participate in, Save or Die. Please check them out, saveordie.info. There's a commercial. I didn't get to go to Origins, so we did free RPG Day. And the reason I'm jealous, Jeffrey, is because I thought our group was going to run Tower out of time. And so I had a chance to play, and Rick Hulls was going to run it in the morning Saturday. I passed. And then we ended up playing the Imperishable Sorceress, the free RPG Day adventure. It was still a lot of fun, although we tried the same thing you tried. We were facing a demon and looking at a TPK, and the wizard whipped out Invoke Patron, and I was playing a halfling, and I jacked him up with a big luck bonus. And that's when we discovered he picked a really lame patron. It was, I can't pronounce the name because my dyslexia is kicking my ass, but it's that chaotic mad wizard patron.
Cesar Khan?
There's the guy. He did us no favors whatsoever.
What did he do, teleport the wizard 1,000 miles away?
That was one of the spell checks he could have taken, but we declined. but we survived it, and we managed to get through it. Tomorrow, Rick Hall is going to run us through the, I think, what's probably going to be the last third of Colossus Arise. We had playtested it a few weeks ago, and an 8-hour playtest session didn't get us all the way through it, so he's generously agreed to run 13 of us through the rest of the module.
Holy moly.
That's a big group. Seven was an experience for me.
I've never been able to run with more than seven. It just seems like, for me, just too confusing. It gets bogged down.
Oh, I've seen Mr. Curtis do it and do it with panache.
What's the biggest group you've run, Michael?
I can handle up to 12, but I don't prefer to do so. Not because I can't do it personally, but just because I find that, you know, the players get a little antsy because they're sitting there waiting for their turn to go. So it kind of breaks down. But yeah, I mean, 12 is no problem for me. You know, I can keep the story flowing, but I get concerned about player participation because I want them to have a good time at the table. So I don't want them to be, you know, sitting there, especially if we're doing something with like static, like, you know, 3.5 or DCC initiative where you have to kind of wait until everything comes around for your turn again.
I'm the weakest one of the group. 4 or 5 is my comfort threshold running a game. I'm gonna have to up my game.
No, don't feel competition is what it, you know.
Well, no, I got a couple things, a couple little skunk work projects going that are DCC related, and sooner or later I'm gonna have to run a play test, which means I'm gonna have to study at the feet of you masters. Okay, well, that'll wrap it up for Tavern Talk. Let's summon up some emails.
You've got mail.
Message for you, sir.
Summon email.
Okay, and our first question comes from Stinky One-Eyed Ogre over on our forums at osrgaming.org. Good show again. Judge Stevens seemed very happy when I sent him the link. Hopefully Dimworld Firebeard will survive another of his sessions. I'm working on a level 0 funnel for a new group. It will be my first time behind the screen in DCC. Any tips on monster design for 0 level? Yeah, that's a great question, and I think we should kick that over to Michael, since he's probably the best able to answer it.
You know, it's going to sound flippant, but the best way to take care of it is just make it up and don't get bogged down about it. For a zero level funnel, let me see. What I would do is I would open up my handy dandy Dungeon Crawl Classics role playing book and take a look in there for kind of a low level monster, just to give you an idea about you know, what kind of thing we're looking for. If you take a look, probably in the back toward Joe's adventure, the zero level funnel in there, which I want to say is the Portal Under the Stars.
Yes.
You can take a quick look at that and you get some idea about, you know, what kind of game stats we're looking at for something that would be challenging, but not, you know, not a guaranteed party wipe. I'm just looking at this right now, and I see a lot of things here which have, not a great armor class, anywhere from 8 and 12. I mean, you have to figure out that for a zero-level funnel, we're not dealing with a lot of modifiers to two-hit rolls and stuff. So you don't want to go overboard on doing the, doing AC. The same thing would go for saving throws. A plus one probably down the line might be your easiest bet. And maybe even a plus one initiative modifier, if not actually a negative modifier, if we're just talking hard mechanics. Maybe 1 to 4 points of damage, 1 to 6 points of damage on an attack, because if we're dealing, again, zero-level characters, unless we start bringing a heavy stamina bonus in it, at best you're talking about 4 hit points. So a single hit from any creature like that would be enough to lay a PC down for good, depending on what his stats are like. I mean, that's just the hard mechanics part of that is very simple. The fun and the challenging part is something which DCC is very adamant about being, which is making monsters unique and making monsters interesting, not what is to be expected.
Allow me to quote Joseph from the rulebook. He says, a key element of player experience in Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game is a sense of wonderment. Your job as judge is to convey the sense of the unknown that was so easy to achieve when we were children who did not know all the rules. One way to achieve this is to make monsters mysterious.
And that's very true. I've done that pretty much my entire career, it's just a matter of taking the stats for any sort of run-of-the-mill monster and just changing the physical description of it. I ran a Labyrinth Lord game for a while, and the characters ran into this race of humanoid cockroaches that were inhabiting the dungeon, and they were threatening them with spears, and they had no idea what these things were. It involved a lot of testing it out and running in fear, and they didn't know what these things were capable of, and they were sure they were these kind of sentient humanoid cockroaches, but I was just using the stats for kobolds for them. The only thing that I changed was the way I described them.
And I think that's important for people to remember, new judges to DCC, is it's not super complicated. You can steal the stats from something out of the book and just layer on your own description, and even, like you said, make a big change from a kobold to, something completely different, and, do that relatively quickly in the most cases, and still come up with something that your party just has no idea what they're up against without a lot of work from the judge.
So thanks, Stinky One Eye Ogre. We appreciate the forum message. Jeffrey, did you have the other email?
I do. This was an email sent to theband@spellburn.com. Came in a couple days ago. It's an email from Tim Callahan, and he writes, "Hey guys, glad to see a DCC podcast and glad to hear you three doing it. Jim, I have long thought that you were a great addition to Save or Die, and it's nice to hear you tackle the madness and fun of Dungeon Crawl Classics with the rest of the new crew. Here's my question for everyone, since I have this stuff in my mind, as I'm doing something on the topic over at the Tor website, but I want to hear what you have to say. Joseph Goodman cites Gary Gygax's Appendix N as a big influence on his revamp of the system for DCC. So I'm wondering, what Appendix N author or authors influence your gaming sensibilities the most? And is it a conscious part of your gaming, or is it something you just recognize in retrospect, if at all? Thanks, and keep on rocking, Tim."
Thanks, Tim. Let's round robin this. You want to just start, Jeffrey?
For me, it's possibly a little cliched, but I think Robert Howard's Conan is certainly foundation point of my Appendix N literature. I mean, there's a lot out there, and I think what I take from it as far as, and I'm not sure it's conscious, but I think what I take from it is the Conan stories, just, they're always moving. There's not a lot of downtime. I mean, some classic fantasy has long journeys and travel and descriptions and details, and Conan, when I read that, it's just, you're constantly moving from one fire to another fire to another fire, and then you mix in the swords and sorcery with the magic in the world is not to be trusted. It's scary. So I think Robert Howard and Conan forms a basis for a lot of my Appendix N thoughts.
How about you, Judge Job?
Probably Fritz Leiber is my favorite. The way that the main characters, Fafford and the Grey Mouser, have basically patrons. It looked like it was a big influence on the writers of Dungeon Crawl Classics RPG, especially when I read, Harley Stroh's adventures. If you've read the Grey Mouser and Fafford stories, you'll see a lot of the stuff kind of plucked out, or, references to things right out of those stories.
Right. Okay. For me, it's Jack Vance. I love that our answers are all completely different, too, by the way. But I just completely fell in love with Jack Vance, which I didn't read until after I had started playing AD&D back in the day. And as soon as I saw how the spell system worked in those books, but it's more than that. It's the setting that on the surface seems medieval fantasy with wizards and magic, but as you read the books, I don't want to spoil a 40-year-old book for anybody, but, you know, it's the dying earth is the setting. So it's millions of years in the future. The sun has gone dim. And underneath this medieval fantasy setting, there's this race of ancients and some old technology. And the magic is, in fact, explained as having been a super science combination of, which will sound very familiar to D&D players, you know, of motion and sound and things being calculated a certain way in your head. But more than that, just the sort of Jack Vance, those books, the Dying Earth books, sort of embody, I think, Gygax's take on an approach to D&D, like the alignment system and things like that, where it's very game and player character oriented. Rialto the Magnificent and Kugel the Clever, is that how you pronounce it?
I think so.
Oh, yeah, Kugel the Clever. If there was a movie in the 70s done of this, it should totally have been played by Jonathan Harris, because Kugel the Clever is the Dr. Smith from Lost in Space of the Jack Vance books. You know, that sort of, I'm a thief, I'm going to steal this mage's scroll, rip it open, and try and get a spell off. I love that. It informs my gaming, because I like fantasy gaming campaign that's not afraid to flex and step a little outside its genre, as you guys already know. It's not beneath my wizard to have a 45 or a laser rifle in his backpack.
How about you, Michael?
For me, hands down, 24/7, 365 days a week, it's a even 50-50 split between Fritz Leiber and Clark Ashton Smith, both of whom I actually discovered rather later in life. I knew about Leiber's work from the old Deities and Demigods. I know Janelle Jackway's illustrations of the Grandmaster and Fafhrd and all the rest of the assorted cast in there were very, very evocative when I was a young kid. But my local library didn't have any Leiber in stock. And, this was before I realized that you could do interlibrary loans and everything. So I only kind of tangentially knew about Leiber's work from Deities and Demigods until I got to college. And then when I was in college, for some reason, I discovered that my college library had the complete run of Leiber's, Twain Tales down in the stack somewhere. And I kind of devoured those over the course of a couple of weeks. And it completely changed the way that I approached fantasy role playing with my kind of, my D&D game at the time and everything. Before that, it was more, Savage Sword of Conan and equal parts Tolkien and like the Dragonlance books. But once I discovered Leiber, there was just I like to believe I have a pretty decent sense of humor, and it tends to come out at the table. Despite how seriously I take things, I'm there to have a good time. And I just found there's a humor and a humanity in Leiber, which I didn't find really in, no offense against, Robert E. Howard, but, Conan, despite for saying that he has, is full of great mirth, is not a really funny guy. I mean, other than,
I chopped his head off. Ha ha ha.
Yeah, he is certainly not. Certainly not a lot of humor in Conan that I've seen.
No, but with Leiber's tales, I mean, they're just the repartee between the two of them. It's almost like an old road movie. The two of them just, they get up to hijinks and everything. I know it's not one of his most, for some reason, there a lot of people are down on it, but his full-length Lankmar novel, Swords of Lankmar, no matter what you think about the novel itself, that the first chapter of that book is the perfect synopsis for for a PC adventure role-playing situation. It's where Mouser and Fafhrd are returning back to Lankmar, and they are completely broke, and all of their creditors are waiting for them at the gate. It's just a humorous little take on it that you could see almost every unsuccessful adventurer having to face. So if you're not familiar with it, I mean, even if you don't read the book, just read the first chapter. But then with Clark Ashton Smith he is just such a command of language just kind of blows me away. He used to get, he used to submit stuff to Weird Tales all the time, and he would constantly get rejection letters from, I guess it was Farnsworth, I think, at the time. It was just like, Smith, this reads like a damn prose poem. Our readers aren't this erudite. They're not this bright. But his work just runs the entire gamut from sword and sorcery to kind of, futuristic futuristic, weird sci-fi to, you know, almost the Vancian Dying Earth. He's got his own tales on, you know, the final days of the Earth and, you know, the weird sorcerers of Atlantis. And it's funny. It's, you know, Smith's work was not included in the original Appendix N, but I still find it to be some of the best synopsis for that kind of genre of hard sword and sorcery, anything goes gaming. A library and Clark Ashton Smith, hands down.
I totally agree with the humor in Fritz Lieber, because I remember that old Dragon article he wrote where they just completely broke the fourth wall, and it was Fritz Lieber interviewing Fofford and the Grey Mouser.
Uh-huh.
For Dragon Magazine.
Yeah, the other thing I love about the humor in those stories is it kind of parallels the kind of joking that goes around the table. It just kind of fits in with gamers.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, well, there you go, Tim. There are some good answers. Let's go ahead and go to the interview section for our special guest and invoke Patron.
I sent my elf spies to find out what was happening.
If I were creating a world, I wouldn't mess about with butterflies and daffodils. I would have started with lasers. 8 o'clock, day one. Go! Sorry.
Invoke Patron!
Well, Michael, thank you for joining us.
Hey, no problem. Pleasure to be here.
It's not your first time on the show, but it's the first time anybody's going to ever hear it.
Well, yes, it's let's just pretend it's the first time that, you know.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
For listeners who don't know, Michael was kind enough to record a pilot episode for Spellburn with us that, due to various audio and technical difficulties, will never see the light of day.
The lost episodes.
So thank you for coming back and giving us a second chance.
No problem. Do you still have the original track for the pilot recorded? Do you still have that on your hard drive?
I'll never tell.
Well, because I'm going to say, you know, you burn that to a CD or a DVD and everything, and give us about, you know, 5 years or something. I'm sure you can probably part with a couple bucks for it at, you know, in North Texas or something. You know, they'll auction anything down there.
Maybe if we hang on to it long enough, audio technology will advance sufficiently to take that echo out.
Right.
I just thought we'd interview and ask you any questions that occur to us, kind of freeform format, just sort of work our way through the Michael Curtis oeuvre of work. The obvious starting place, since this is Spellburn, would be with Dungeon Crawl Classics RPG, which you've had more than just a hand in.
Maybe a hand and a wrist. I have been involved in DCC from the alpha stage. I was brought into it after Joe and Harley had pretty much assembled. It was primarily Joe, but I don't want to short shrift anybody. So he had assembled. He had pretty much the game set the way that he wanted it to be, and he had been doing kind of semi-public play testing with it and stuff. So it was assembled up to the alpha stage, and he sent me a copy of it, and, you know, trying to get my feedback on it. And so I gave it a look over it, and, you know, provided him with, well, you know, this is cool, you know, maybe we could do this, you know, a little bit differently here and what have you. You know, I think maybe one or two of my suggestions, you know, finally made it to the final draft or anything. But so that was originally the breadth of my involvement with it.
Well, let me ask you a question that might back the train up a second. How do you get to be in a position where Joseph Goodman and Harley Stroh call you up and ask you for feedback in the first place?
Because of my relationship with them, with the Dungeon Alphabet at this point. The Dungeon Alphabet had already been out and released and was at the time pretty much Goodman's most popular product. And actually, the Dungeon Alphabet kind of served as the preliminary kind of test draft for Dungeon Crawl Classics, not in a writing sort of way, but just doing layout and art. Before the Dungeon Alphabet came out, Joe definitely wanted to integrate something which had a lot of art mixed in with the text and what have you, which I guess if you look at some of the older DCC modules, the layout was very different. So the Dungeon Alphabet layout kind of served as the dry run for what the DCC rulebook would eventually look like. And if you kind of go back and look at the original, the Dungeon Alphabet, you can see that kind of integration of artwork and text and everything. So at that point, you know, I mean, I was on good terms with them, and, you know, Joe knew I could write, and I guess he respected my opinion enough that he, you know, gave it back to me and said, gave me the alpha test and said, okay, well, you know, what do you think? So we'd already kind of established a relationship by that point. That's why I got called in. So that was originally, you know, just other than providing a couple of notes, that was the extent of my involvement with Dungeon Crawl Classics, the actual rules. But then when it went into beta test, Joe's original plan was that DCC was going to max out at fifth level. You wouldn't, you know, at fifth level was going to be the apex of the adventuring, you know, career.
Wow. So not even 10th, fifth.
Not even 10th. No. But when the beta was released, there were some people were like, well, you know, like why is only fifth level the, you know, the highest level and everything, you know, I mean, especially when you're coming from it with even going far enough back to, I mean, even, BX where 14th was the highest level. And then of course, you know, the BECMI versions of, you know, D&D where, you know, you go to 30th or, you know, what have you. And then 3.5 in Pathfinder, you know, 20 is generally the maximum. So people were kind of expecting more. So Joe said, okay, kind of as a, you know, I'll meet you halfway. And rather than fifth level, 10th level will be the maximum.
Oh, wait, I got this. So with higher levels came higher level of spells.
Exactly. So which he hadn't had, you know, he hadn't had the prep work for, and he had, you know, a lot more to do with it. So that was when he was like, Mike, how do you feel like identifying the iconic D&D spells and trying to, you know, figure out which ones we should include in DCC and writing up the various charts for them and doing the corruption and the misfires and all the rest of that. So basically anything above any fourth or fifth level spells, the blame can fall on me for, as well as all of the quote unquote, the name spells as well. Cause Joe decided that, you know, in the classic D&D and the Jack Vance, you know, tradition, he wanted there to be certain spells that, you know, shared the names of their creators. So
there you go.
So I managed to, those were my creations, and all of them are kind of, you know, inside jokes or what have you. So
I was about to ask, I'm dying to know, because I know Sword of Kos was named for Tim Kask. I know a lot of the AD&D ones. So can you let our listeners in on one of the secret naming conventions?
Oh,
there's Joseph Backwards is one of them.
Yes. That's a Hepsoge Fecund Fungus. That was definitely a nod to Joe. And there is also Ekim's Mystical Mask, which is not too far to go out on a limb to see that Ekim Backwards in true Dwar Jim form is actually just Mike Backwards. And there's also, you know, just because when you're giving a designer free reign, he's going to take advantage of it. The other one is Nithul's Porcupine Coat, which is Nithul is kind of a homophone for Michael. So there you go.
what price immortality?
Yes, exactly.
So which side of the fence did you fall on the fifth versus 10th level debate?
I didn't have a strong opinion for it. I mean, this was Joe's game, and if he wanted to go to fifth level, fine. I mean, I've been playing for more than 30 years, and I think I've had one character who ever broke 10th level. I think 12th level is the highest I ever got. So really high level campaigns I don't have a lot of interest in, to be honest, just because I don't get the chance to experience them, just because either the campaign breaks down or people get tired or what have you.
Right.
So my sweet spot is I always say that I don't have a good hand on a character until I hit third. You know, first and second level for me is just backstory, just trying to figure out, you know, trying to get a handle on it role-playing wise. And then once about third level kicks in, I'm like, okay, all right, I got an idea. I can play this guy. And then, you know, so fifth level would have been fine if that was, you know, especially if that is the, all right, you are godlike, and this is the time to start clearing the wilderness and, you know, establishing a castle or a hideout or what have you. I mean, that would have been fine for me.
Probably worth mentioning to, in case folks haven't actually played the game yet, that if you want to try and equate power levels in the game, you basically would double the level in Dungeon Crawl Classics to get a rough equanimity to the same thing in D&D. So at fifth level, Dungeon Crawl Classics character is around as powerful as a 10th level D&D character.
Right.
And that's what I was going to say, you know, and face value, when I hear fifth level, I think, oh, that's too soon to stop. And now that I've actually played and been playing for, you know, about a little over a year, fifth level's a pretty darn powerful character, and it takes a while to get there, and I'm fine with going to 10th, but you know, fifth's not as low as it sounds in DCC, it doesn't seem like.
Right. You know, fifth level, your wizard gets fireball, and that's of course a complete game changer.
especially if you spell burn it, so.
Right.
My favorite spell on the planet.
I mean, because, you know, a fifth level wizard DCC, high enough spell check, that's the same equivalent of Meteor Swarm in, you know, AD&D. So.
Exactly. Spellburn's a game changer. Even just spell checks with nice bonuses.
You didn't write Fireball, did you, Michael?
No. Fireball was already well established by the time that I came in.
Okay,
well then moving on from the core rule book, you've obviously written several of the adventures.
Yeah. I think we're up to, including the one I just submitted, I think I've done 7 now in various states of either release or, you know, soon to be released or somewhere down the line. So after the success of the Dungeon Alphabet and DCC, Joe was like, okay, the first one I did was a fourth level adventure called A Miracle Was Framed, which is again it's an homage, a basic, you know, well, we call it an homage, but it's inspired by the classic Trampy picture from the old DMG, which anybody who was familiar with the first edition DMG, that's, you know, one of the iconic ones in there. And so Joe was putting together, I guess they already had a couple adventures kind of, you know, completed that he and Harley had written. Joe said, okay, he said, I have a pitch for you. And so he said, like, here's the pitch. A miracle was framed. That's all he gave me. So I actually have.
And your demented brain suddenly went, okay, I'm going to start with that drawing and I'm going to add flying monkeys.
Yeah, exactly. That's quite the leap to the flying monkey part.
The flying monkey part is a sneaky appendix and kind of throwback as well. Before the adventure process, you know, had really got started, Joe had been kind of sending out some emails of like, all right, there are certain kind of ideas that he wanted to try to incorporate. And, you know, aside from Gygax's appendix and, you know, he wanted to go with this retro 1970s vibe to it. So we were talking about some of the other things that we could possibly, you know, pull from. And we still do that. And, you know, I can't reveal some of them, but I'm like, oh, man, I thought I'm the only guy who remembered that reference. But one of the things he did, he was like, okay, can we throw like this Planet of the Ape vibe thing? I want to touch on that. I was like, fine, yeah, all right, flying monkeys. And not even thinking of the fact that, you know, was again subconscious infection from various sources, I realized that Elric had fought, you know, winged monkeys in one of his adventures. So it's a kind of an unofficial.
Oh,
you know,
Dorothy fought winged monkeys.
Right. So it's an unintentional, you know, appendix and reference as well.
I totally opened that module looking for the Tin Golem and didn't see it.
Michael, of all the adventures that have been published so far, which one is your favorite or are you most proud of?
The whatever one I just finished, to be perfectly honest.
And since you just submitted one, what can you tell us about it, if anything?
I don't quite know what the protocol is for things, because I'm still waiting back on notes for it and everything. But I will reveal that it is inspired by an Appendix N series. It's not one that you will expect. And it's actually kind of takes a step away from your in a lot of ways, your classic when you think about sword and sorcery. If all goes according to plan, it is fifth level, and it's a combination both hex crawl and dungeon crawl. There's something for hopefully for everybody. And we haven't really had a real hex crawl adventure for the new DCC series yet. So hopefully, you know, if all goes according to plan, it'll be interesting. But that one, since I just submitted that, technically that's not the one I'd be most proud of yet until I get feedback from Joe. So technically, I guess the most proud one would be, of course, the Tower Out of Time, which is the one that has just been released as part of Free RPG Day. And, you know, I know this has been run by at least one of you. So,
yes, I've run it. It was a great time had by the players. I'll tell you that.
A great time. I saw what you did there.
I'm very happy with that one because it seems to be working as intended. Is that I've heard a lot of reports that kind of the big bad at the end of it, his spell chucks run either hot or cold. So when I did a playtest, he blew one of his two defensive spells, which resulted in a lot of fun. But I've heard other reports saying that he's blown both of them because DCC is a swingy system and sometimes the dice just don't come your way, even if you are supposed to be the big bad guy at the end of it. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Sometimes it's late at a con game and you decide that it's time to end the game and you burn 20 points of spell burn and 5 of luck to take out the big bad.
Right. or you inadvertently paralyze the big thing that is going to drain away all your corruption and return your wizard to be squeaky clean. Then.
We played that. We killed it before we got any chance to do that.
In the playtest, they actually killed it while the wizard was inside it.
Oh, well, at least my group held off that long. They didn't wait. They didn't wait for me to climb in.
No. So Tower Out of Time would be the my latest, most proud baby. It always kind of depends on what happens once I release the child into the wild. And from what I've heard, people seem to be enjoying it. So I'm happy with that. It was a short little one. And hopefully people won't think that I'm stuck on a time travel thing. Because although there is sort of this time dimensional aspect to Tower of the Time, it is, you know, it is very different from the other adventure which I have coming out, which has time in the title. So there you go.
Well, speaking of feedback, at the end of the show, we three judges are going to discuss our favorite Michael Curtis book, game, or adventure. So you'll get some feedback from us.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm allowed to participate in that. That's where you turn me off and you guys, you know, you guys trash talk.
No, you may retort if you wish. You think our choices are poor? Well, you talked a little bit about the Dungeon Alphabet. It just went into its third printing, right?
Yeah, it did, surprisingly. Yeah, I'm very, very pleased that that has attracted the audience and the feedback and the response that it has gotten, considering it really just started as kind of as a way for me to take a week-long break from writing my blog at the time. I figured I would do a short little kind of roundup of the classic dungeon tropes, you know, from at that point, I guess it was 29 years of gaming, things to expect when you're in the dungeon, and I didn't expect anything else to come of it. And lo and behold, that was my foot in the door in the quote unquote the industry. Joseph sent me an email and said, "This is really cool. Would you like to develop this for a gaming supplement?" And having grown up reading the TSR profiles in Dragon magazine and saying, "Wow, you know, these guys sound like they have the best job in the world. I would love to do that." It was, you know, it was a dream come true for me.
If you have the Dungeon Alphabet in one hand and the random esoteric creature generator in the other hand, you can write professional level adventures. That's what I think.
It's an excellent resource. I mean, whenever you're stuck for, you know, a gap or like you've got something and, you know, you've got an altar that, you know, you need, you can just turn to the Dungeon Alphabet and now the altar is suddenly something really cool. And it didn't take a lot of brain power for me to come up with it. So I think it's a great resource. I'll just say I don't think it's a surprise that it's in a third printing yet. It's a good solid book.
It's like you have a little prescription bottle full of Michael Curtis demented dungeon pills that you can take whenever you want.
Exactly. You just shake them up and roll them out on a table and, oh, now I've got something to work with.
My entire philosophy when writing that. I didn't want to do this is how you do it. This is how you must do it. You know, you were limited to the options I am presenting you and everything. It was intended to be a springboard. I mean, it was really, you know, if you're stuck for an idea, take a look at this. And, you know, if you don't necessarily like something which might be in the table or something that, you know, I talk about in one of the short essays, at least it will get the gears, hopefully it will get the gears spinning and you might be able to, you know, pluck something else out of it. It's funny, I say that I wrote the Dungeon Alphabet because it was a book I had been waiting for 30 years and nobody had written it. So unfortunately that job fell to me. So
I don't know if you guys like this idea, but when I was thinking earlier about Dungeon Denizens, I was thinking maybe we could like roll on R is for Rooms page and kind of use that as like a constraint for our monster that we design.
That's a good idea, except I'll have to rely on you guys because my gaming stuff is still packed up.
Yeah, I have it open. It just roll once and then we'll figure out the rest.
And now, are we using the original or the expanded third printing?
I'm using the gold foil. That's what I have in front of me.
Well, moving on from the Dungeon Alphabet, you're also infamous for being the creator and publisher of Stonehell Dungeon, which I just recently had the privilege of dropping a few levels into.
Well, you didn't get the typical Stonehell treatment, I'll tell you that much. Yeah, Stonehell Dungeon, the great albatross that is around my neck and is slowly moving ahead at glacier pace. Because although I had been playing for many, many years, I had never done a classic style jumbo Saturday night special mega dungeon. My stuff had already been smaller. I had been out of the hobby for a while, for pretty much from my college years up until about 6 years ago. Kind of when I got back to it, got involved with the old school renaissance. At the time, it seemed to be like back in the day, it was kind of the masterwork project of every dungeon master from going from journeyman status to actual dungeon master was to build a big, you know, 10, 20 level mega dungeon. And I had never done that. So I figured, okay, with what was going on in this kind of...
If I'm going to do it, I might as well make some cash out of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't a cash cow idea, to be honest. I really thought I'd be lucky to get $50. You know, I mean, it's not a very expensive book. I mean, the print copy itself is, I think, what, $13? And that's 134 pages and, you know, more than 700 rooms and everything. I mean, granted, I did all the layout and the art was either contributed for free, you know, for pay and trade or was clip art. The bang for the buck you're getting is far exceeds most what most products, professionally or, you know, amateurly done, what you can get nowadays. You know, when I released it, people were like, oh, I would pay a hell of a lot more for this. So I was like, don't tell me that.
Well, and everything we've talked about so far, obviously Dungeon Crawl Classics and the Dungeon Alphabet can be had or ordered through a brick and mortar game store. Where can somebody get Stonehill Dungeon?
Stonehill Dungeon is currently it is available at lulu.com. It's not available through RPG Now or DriveThruRPG. That was because when I did it 5 years ago, though, I really wanted it to be available in hard copy. Because I am a diehard fan. I have to have the book in my hand. I want to ruffle and finish it and smell the paper and what have you. And so at that point, there was no print on demand option for RPG Now or DriveThruRPG. So Lulu was the only way to get that available. So they're still there available on Lulu. You can go through my site, the Society of Torch Pole and Rope, poleandrope.blogspot.com, or I'm sure the link will be thrown up at some point. But yeah, I mean, it's available through there. You can get the original levels 1 through 5. I also have 2 supplements as well. Little small thing. One is free and one is a couple of bucks. And at some point this year, the culmination of it, levels 6 through 10, will be released, and I will be very, very happy that the dungeon is complete and that project is fun and finished. I love the dungeon and everything, but it's just been.
Can you tell us how many more rooms are you going to be adding there?
I mean, I'm not adding any more rooms.
No, I mean, how many are in the 5 through 10 or 6?
I don't have a full count. It's actually bigger than the first one, size-wise. So the dungeon key and the levels are all done. The maps are all done. I actually just got finished rereading the original book because, like I said, I did that 5 years ago, and I wanted to make sure I didn't, you know, miss any glaring, you know, this will be summed up in adventure number, you know, in book number 2, and I finished book number 2 and never, you know, never get back to that. So then the next phase basically is just doing revisions and a preliminary layout for editing. So it's moving forward glacially slow, but I'm set to have it out this year. So. I appreciate everybody's patience for this, but Stonehill has kind of been a victim of my own success. So since it's my own vanity project, it's the only thing I can really afford to keep pushing back, deadline-wise.
I got to say that people keep asking me what was the most fun game I played in at North Texas RPG Con, and even over the Dungeon Crawl Classics game was the Great Stonehill Laser Massacre. Where we all played basically mutants who got tripped through a portal and got dumped into the bowels of Stonehill. People, which leads me to a question. People keep asking me, I'd never played in Stonehill before. You were in Stonehill? What level were you on? I'm like, I have no idea. There was a gladiator ring full of goblins that we wiped out. Does that tell you?
Actually, it won't, because that was just something I specifically cooked up for North Texas.
That's perfect.
It's funny. It's every time I run Stonehill at a convention, it's always something which has never, it's just never part of the established quote unquote Stonehill canon, just because I want to have, it's easier for me to cook up a small little, okay, we're going to cover this much during a 4 or 6 hour con slot. You know, I want you to come to the table not knowing what to expect. Actually, it's my third section of Stonehill, which is not available for public consumption. No.
So there's a good reason to sign up for your games at the cons.
Oh, right.
Now, Stonehill was written for Labyrinth Lord, right?
Yes, it is.
Being Spellburn, do you think it'd be a good candidate for conversion to DCC, either not necessarily by you, but by a DM, a judge looking to run something in there? Do you think it'd convert well? Is it strange enough?
You know what? Honestly, I don't think it's a good match for DCC. Okay. Just because it was done, a lot of people tend to look at DCC as just a kind of another retro clone. But, I mean, you guys all know, I mean, although there's a lot of similarities, DCC is its, I mean, just design aesthetics, aesthetics-wise and kind of end game, it is is different than AD&D. I mean, AD&D, you know, or AD&D, BXD&D, basically anything that, I mean, kind of the established dungeon crawl, kill the monster, collect the treasure and everything. And because it has its roots, because of, you know, the original versions of D&D have their roots in like the wargaming mentality and that kind of prolonged mega dungeon centric campaign, the play style is different. I personally wouldn't run Stonehell as a DCC game. I mean.
So what you're saying is the mega dungeon concept itself is antithetical to the flavor of DCC RPG.
I'm saying that for me personally. I know people have done conversions of Greg Gillespie's Barrow Maze and stuff, and they're having a great time with that and everything. But for me personally, I don't think that the mega dungeon and the Appendix N philosophy of DCC is necessarily compatible. But again, that's just my own take on it.
I agree with you. I mean, that said, we have a rule around this podcast that however you and your group are doing it, if you're having fun, you're doing it right.
Right.
So could you? Sure.
Right. And that's sort of what I found, that some stuff fits. I've taken some older stuff and converted it to DCC, and it's worked because it had some, it was either short or it had some strange thing to it that did, I think, lend itself well to the DCC genre. But I agree. Not everything converts well. I don't think I could take anything off my shelf and necessarily convert it to DCC. So I was just curious about that, how Stonehell would fit in with that.
Well, right. The published DCC adventures are all very, the charm of them is they're kind of in and out. I mean, they have their complexities, but it's not on the map.
Exactly, yes.
Right. I mean, one of Joseph's design philosophies with DCC, with the adventures, are, I mean, they're much shorter. I mean, they harken back to the original TSR modules where, you know, 16 pages in and out. And that has, I think the philosophy I know behind that is, one is, especially older gamers, they just don't have time to go and sit down and do have, you know, a prolonged, okay, we're going to, for the next year, we're going to be doing this campaign. We're going to be doing, you know, the equivalent of, you know, Queen of the Demon Web Pits or, you know, Against the Slavers or one of like the Pathfinder Adventure Paths. If they want something that they can sit and they have a good time with their friends and, you know, they get feel like, you know, they have, you know, they get something accomplished and, you know, either, you know, succeed or die in the attempt. So there's that aspect to it. But there's also, if you look back to the Appendix N sources of inspiration from it, a lot of the Appendix N stuff was short stories. I mean, they were kind of the adventure of the week. I mean, although people have tried to, you know, tie Conan's story into some sort of, you know, logical, chronological timeline. I mean, that's not what Robert E. Howard intended. I mean, it was just like, this is it during this place during Conan's life, and this is during this place, or, you know, Fafhrd the Mouser, this happened, and then, you know, and then the next time we pick it up, they're over here. So there's a lot of that mentality.
Well, like, John Carter didn't spend a third of the book in the Black Pits. He was, you know, it was a chapter. He was in and out.
Mm-hmm.
On to the next adventure.
Right. So for me, that's one of the reasons why I don't think the extended same place, same kind of massive dungeon complex works for DCC for me. I would much rather have it. OK, this week we're going into the jungle. We're going after the Lost Pyramid and we're going to fight the Snake Men and, you know, recover the grand jewel of, you know, of the Lich Maharaja or something like that. And then we do that for a couple of sessions. And then, you know, next week we're on a pirate ship and, you know, we're, you know, and then a week, you know, a couple of weeks after that, we're on the moon, you know. that just for me is more of the Appendix N DCC kind of style of play. But
yeah, and I think that style of play, you said it earlier, it fits in with the sort of the, I hate to say older because that's almost classifying me as older, but with our busy schedules, you know, families and jobs and everything like that, where, you know, you just sort of want to sit down and you don't necessarily want to get tied into a 6 week, 8 week delve into the same thing all the time, and the nugget sized adventures where it's a couple sessions and, like you said, you go get the jewel here and then 2 weeks later you're getting the, you know, you're on the pirate ship and stuff. You really switch it up, keeps things moving. So yeah, I think that's hits a lot of great points about DCC and where it fits in with the people that play it.
Right.
Okay. Well, that was a way better interview than on the pilot episode, so thank you, sir.
No problem.
We're going to do a new segment, a new version of Dungeon Denizens for our shows in which we have a special guest or an interviewee. So we're going to do a version of Dungeon Denizens where we, the hosts and our guests, collaborate on creating a monster. So let's go to Dungeon Denizens.
Go on, boss. Chop his head off.
Right, silly little speeder.
Jesus Christ!
My armor is like tenfold shields.
My teeth are like swords. My claws, spears.
Okay, we've never done this before, so it's a free-for-all.
Yeah, this ought to be fun.
Well, since we have Michael, I was thinking that it would be a great idea to use the dungeon alphabet and roll up a room and then maybe come up with a DCC monster that fits in with, you know, that environment.
I think that's an excellent suggestion, and since I happen to know you've got it right in front of you, you want to start off with the room?
Sure, but I don't have 2d10. I think I heard someone rolling dice earlier.
I got it.
All right. Let's hear it.
That was a 13.
13 on R is for rooms. So we have spell amplifier. Spells cast while in this room produce the maximum spell effects.
Oh, God.
Also known as the TPK room.
So whatever, there's some kind of spell casting ability is going to be needed here.
Let's see what happens when I break the staff of magi. Awesome roll. Good start.
Oh my
okay.
God. Oh my God. Okay.
So do we want to start with a name?
So we're coming up with the monster that lives in the spell amplifying room.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Michael, when you design a new monster, where do you start usually?
Usually, it depends. I guess I don't really have any established protocol for it. It depends on what I'm, you know, what my source is coming from, you know, what the tone of the adventure. Sometimes I just say, okay, you can never go wrong with throwing a big Frank Frazetta snake in for DCC. That's
so spellcasting snake it is.
There you go.
It's a big spellcasting snake. All right. So
what would be funny is if he just had one spell, because that's all he needs in the spell amplifying room.
Yeah, we just give him fireball and it should be handled.
Wait, okay, let's decide what his spell is going to be. I think I've got my PDF.
Well, what if since it's a snake, what if it, instead of just normal scales, it has some sort of like mirror-like scale pattern on it that actually that is responsible for the amplification of magic. And maybe it actually preys on magic itself. And one of it's kind of evolved in this thing where it tries to actually get you to throw spells at it to kind of self-cook your own prey. That's
or maybe the spells, it like soaks them up and then shoots them back at you or something. Like it doesn't have any kind of arcane magic on its own.
Hey, Mike, you might want to dial it back a few notches because we're not paying you for this, you know.
Well, you know.
But I like that. It absorbs a spell. The next round spits it back at you, amplified.
Right.
Ooh. All right, so that's fair. So this is a monster where you do want to run right in and chop it.
Right. This is definitely where, you know, your mighty deeds come in handy rather than, oh, okay, I'm going to spell burn and, you know, blast this thing in Bolivian. So I think
so rather than the snake having spells, it just reflects back whatever's shot at it.
Right. At an advanced spell check. So, you know, so if you spell burn and you throw a 20, your spell check is 22 with your fireball, the snake, you know, fires it back to you the following round at, say, you know, +5 to whatever your spell check is. So
you're nice. I was going to do +10.
I was actually thinking +8, but I decided to tone it down a little bit. So if we want to be in the middle.
So +6.
Here's your character funnel. It's just one room. Oh, that's so good. Okay, how about,
well, how does their snake get around? Just the normal snake way, or I kind of feel like maybe we could mix it up, maybe he flies, or maybe he could burrow, maybe he can actually like slither along the ceiling and the walls.
Maybe he slides around on kind of like this trail of mucus, but like the mucus itself has weird kind of magical properties, almost like a random potion if somebody is brave enough to try to consume it.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I do like that.
Man, this is pure gold. Must probably come. He's in this room from a hole in the wall that's his lair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. In my head, I'm in the stat block. I'm thinking like a player instead of a GM. I'm like, okay, what kind of loot's he got?
I usually always try to start from the story angle because then it seems like creates the mechanics, so like how Mike, you know, blurted out the, you know, reflect back a plus 10 spell check.
Well, it's, let's see. All right. So if we want to go from a stat block angle, well, it definitely, let's see, it's, I don't know. I'm thinking maybe this thing that lives in the basement of the, you know, the weird dead archmage or something like that. And I guess maybe he started out as the archmage's familiar. But when the archmage died, he was exposed to all the strange alembics and reagents and what have you in the wizard's kind of storeroom, and has become mutated through it. So he has this. He still dens in kind of like the magical storeroom area, and that's where he drags back his victims. So he's got, you know, mixed in treasure from, you know, things that he's has consumed over the years. So if you want to establish that as a lair, how about that?
Mike, you're my favorite kind of collaborator. To say, hey, how about a snake? And you run with it.
Well, you can never go wrong with it. For me, you can never, you know, I don't use them a lot, but for the classic, I guess it's all like the Conan covers. You know, it always seems like if worse comes to worse, Conan would fight a big snake. Even if that's not necessarily true, in my head it is.
Okay, I'm trying to come up with names. So far, all I got is Sithruk. Hmm.
Slithluck?
Well, I like that better. I was trying to do Curtis backwards.
Oh.
How about a Relp Maw?
Well, we need a name, because one of us is going to have to stat this up and put it on the website for our listeners. What do you think? Just armor class 12?
You know, I'd look at, you know, we could start talking, going back to how we talked earlier in the show, just grab a stat and run with it. The giant snake on page 428, we could start working off something like that for actual stats, and then probably weaken it a bit because it's going to have the sweet spell-like ability. But let's see. Yeah, I mean, there's an AC 14. A giant cobra has an AC 14, so, you know.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Give this
12 wouldn't be out of call since we're giving it some magical bits to it.
A little easier to hit. How many exactly. Hit dice has the giant snake got?
Snakes range from 3d8 to 5d8. The cobra has 3d8, giant viper has 4d8, and a giant boa constrictor is 5d8.
So 3d8.
I like that.
How big are you picturing the snake? I'm still stuck in Frank Frazetta mode. I'm thinking about the thing that Conan fights in the first movie. You know, that's how big the snake is in my head.
It should totally be big.
Yeah, me too.
It should be big, and it should have something to spook the players besides the reflective scale. Something to just when they walk in the room and don't see a giant snake with reflective scales.
Maybe it's got a cobra hood with some sort of weird thing on the actual hood itself. So when it establishes, I don't know, maybe there's
a tentacled
horn,
a tentacled cobra hood. How's that?
Oh, no tentacles.
Yeah, tentacles are overused.
How about a single horn, like a unicorn?
On the tip of his nose, like a rattlesnake stinger, but on his nose, it even rattles. It's dipped in poison.
Okay, well, I think we got a good enough start here. We'll get this written up and put on the website, and people can go play test it, and then write us back how it went.
And, you hear my players play test that you guys might be seeing this.
So if you see a disco snake, a disco ball snake, run.
Yes.
Well, right. And so we'll leave parts of it mysterious. Like we might add a couple of things so that anybody listening doesn't automatically know when they encounter it.
And all of those of you, all your listeners who do end up losing characters to the disco ball snake, please send your hate mail to the band.
Now, see, I kind of like that name right there, the disco ball snake. You just figure out what the Latin words are for disco and ball, and we're set.
I hope to God the Latin, they didn't have, you know, disco in Rome, but, you know, you learn something new every day.
They had isohedron dice, so they probably had disco balls.
Well, again, there we go. We're tapping into the party like it's 1974 vein of Dungeon Crawl Classics.
The disco snake. Okay, I'm really loving this guy now.
Yeah, I think it's a cool one. We'll wrap it up and get it up on the site. I think it'll be awesome.
Yeah. I like it.
Okay. Well, that'll take us to our final segment of the show, Patron Bond.
Who are you?
Your new lord and master.
What orders from Mordor, my lord?
Oh, don't grovel. One thing I can't stand, it's people groveling.
Sorry.
Patron Bond.
All righty. We do a product review or we're talking about something, this is the point where we would normally rate it. But when we have a special guest on, I thought what we would do is each go round robin and discuss our single favorite Michael Curtis book, game, or adventure. You want to start us off, Joe?
Sure. Well, without a doubt, my favorite Michael Curtis book is the Dungeon Alphabet. I love my third printing gold foil edition with the expanded art, and I think it has some extra entries in it too. It'll give you ideas for, you know, anytime you've got any kind of writer's block or you can't come up with a dungeon idea, just open it up and you can either roll on a table or just even looking at the art a lot of times just triggers something in my brain. And it really helps me out. So all the way, a critical hit for the Dungeon Alphabet.
All right, Job. How about you, Jeffrey?
Okay, well, I was sort of hoping I'd go first because I thought other people
would steal Dungeon yours?
Alphabet. Yes, and I was like, I figured Dungeon Alphabet would be the popular one. And so I do think it's probably my top one. But I will, since I recently ran and have read Tower Out of Time, I did enjoy that. It is definitely a strong adventure. I liked that. And what I told people about it after running it is makes for a great con module because it fit in the time length without having to like rush through a whole bunch of stuff and without having to draw stuff out. So the timing of it just sort of fit well with that, which is a great pro. It's weird. It is not normal. So if you're running DCC as a one shot at a con or, you know, a game store, something like that, I think it immediately strikes home that this is not your normal, you know, dungeon crawl. There's something weird with this. And then the other thing is it's being sort of a tower, there's really sort of one path to go. So there's less chance of getting too far astray, which for con games and one shots that I think the Tower Out of Time is great for, or dropping into an existing campaign just, you know, on the side because someone didn't show up and you need something to run real quick or something on the side. I think that helps a lot with a con game or something like that. So I will go with the Tower Out of Time.
Now that I know that's your favorite adventure, I'm going to redouble my efforts to get my hands on one because I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to go with what will be in September published as Dungeon Crawl Classics number 79, Frozen in Time. That's a Michael Curtis adventure that I was privileged to be in a playtest for. And I'm going to speak very carefully, Michael, so that I don't do any spoilers. Is that okay?
That's okay.
It is remarkable. It's like you read my mind and wrote this specifically for me and the way we played when it was 1979 and we were playing. It's a very gonzo adventure that is a loving homage to D&D adventures like Expedition to the Barrier Peaks or Tomb of Horrors. It's very tricky, and it's just got all kinds of spooky player expectation confounding things written into it. And obviously, since you ran the playtest I was in, you know we had a blast.
Yeah.
Blast technically might be a spoiler, but...
I've had a lot of positive feedback on that. I just ran that again down in North Texas, and I've actually just saw the maps. Doug Kovacs has just finished up the maps on that, and they look excellent. I believe it's the only map so far that has an inside joke from an actual playtest, so I appreciate that. If any of you played, if anybody out there is listening and played down in North Texas, you may recognize one of the characters that appear on the map itself. So,
Doug is a great guy. I've really finally gotten to know him a little bit, and in fact, right now on my computer screen, I'm looking at some magnificent art he did for Gygax number 2. I love the way he does those maps. I've tried to draw maps and imitate him, and I can't do it.
Gygax number 2, huh? That's coming out, right?
It's certainly coming out.
Okay. Gygax annual.
Hey, we're on a quarterly schedule. This is number 2 for 2013, so we just have to squeeze out 2 more issues in the next 4 months. That's all.
Got it.
I'm a subscriber. Make them good and put them in my mailbox.
Well, Dungeon Crawl Classic fans, there's Doug Kovacs artwork in it, and it's gorgeous. Okay, there, I pimped that enough.
Now, I should help pay my own bills and keep me in good standing.
There's also a Michael Curtis article that's also very nicely illustrated, albeit not by Doug, in number 2.
Well, I knew about the article. Since Jeffrey was so nice to talk about the Tower Out of Time and pick that as his choice, I just wanted to let people know that Tower Out of Time, if this year Goodman Games has been conducting their world tour, where they're trying to get people out there to play and to run Dungeon Crawl Classics. And if you, it's really easy to get involved on the world tour itself. So you just contact Goodman Games through the website and let them know that you're running a DCC session at a convention or your local game store or for your gaming club. We actually got one. I heard that they're running. One group is running in a middle school and another group is running in a bar. So there's plenty of opportunities.
That is so much awesome.
Yeah. So there's plenty of opportunities to get out there and be a part of the world tour. And if you are part of the world tour running games, you are an official world tour road crew member. And depending on how many games you run, you can get some cool swag out of it. One of which is the Tower Out of Time. You can get a free the free PDF to run that. Completely pre-gens, and you get the opportunity, you can pick it up in hardcover as well. Depending on how many games, you might get anything from just some swag to hang out at your game session, or a cool retro 1970s iron-on to turn your favorite black gaming t-shirt into the gold foil cover of Dungeon Crawl Classics, to a big Horkin DCC brass belt buckle, which I have. And if you run 9 games, there's a super secret surprise, which I'm not even sure what that is. So if you want to get in on the fun, by all means, swing by the Goodman Games website and check out the World Tour 2013 for Dungeon Crawl Classics.
And Jeffrey, you've participated in that, right?
Yeah, I did. That's how I got the Tower Out of Time for Origins, was through the road tour, and it was great. They were super fast. PDF obviously came real quickly, but there was also this box of swag to hand out at your convention table, and it had bookmarks, badge-like pens, pencils, and then the other thing that was a pretty
pens
big
too.
The pens. They were pencils, I think.
I mean, you know, the did you already say buttons?
The badge things, the pens, like a button pen, and then they had the con ribbons, like when people go play, like the that you put on the bottom of your convention badge and things like that, that said DCC RPG. And I actually handed those out pretty early on, and then I'd get stories from people that, you know, at the con that, hey, someone asked me about this blue ribbon on there. So that was a great way to get the word out at a convention where you've got a convention badge you're wearing around to put on. So, and like I said, that stuff arrived really quickly. I think I let them know about a week and a half before I was running, and I still had it in plenty of time for the convention. So it is a great program. We'll make sure to link to it on the Spellburn site.
I can't wait to play it. One of the guys at our game store, Judge Todd, has signed up. Is just in the beginning stages of signing up for the World Tour thing, so he's going to run that for us, and I can't wait to play.
Yeah, I'm on Convention 4 next weekend of the World Tour games I've done.
Excellent.
Sweet. Rick Hall was just bragging that he got his big honking brass belt buckle.
Hey, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm still waiting on my t-shirt. I haven't gotten it yet, but I'll send him an email.
Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for the show. Michael, thank you very much for being our guest again.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Much appreciated.
And I guess that's going to get us out of here. Remember, never split the party unless the party splits first.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes, thank you.
Goodbye, all.
And we're out.